Welcome to another episode of Access to Perspectives Conversations. I'm Joe Haberman, and I'm very happy to introduce to you today Rebecca Lawrence, Managing Director of Faculty 1000. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
It's a real pleasure. So, it's been a while now, and the summer vacations and travels have basically not interrupted, but delayed this recording. So before we go into the evolution of Faculty 1000 and some of the ups and downs and experiences made along the way, as any organization does, you have a pharmaceutical background. What brought you into running an organization or publishing venue like F1000? Basically, what's been your journey, in other words?
Yes, indeed. Well, it's quite a convoluted and long journey, as I think many people's careers are, actually. You're right. I started as a pianist, trained as a pianist right at the beginning, and then moved into pharmacy and trained and qualified as a pharmacist. And then decided I wanted to do research, so I did a PhD in pharmacology, and my original plan was to try and get into the pharmaceutical industry. I was always interested in the practical applications of things, so it was interesting, you know, trying to do research actually might lead to something that might help treat a disease and sort of help society more generally. But while I was looking for those positions, I saw an advert for an assistant editor, copy editing role, basically, on a review journal called Drug Discovery Today, something I'd never thought about doing at all, but just piqued my interest. And I thought, well, might as well apply. Why not? to my astonishment, passed the quite challenging grammar test that came beforehand, had the interview. It was a lovely team of people. And got the job. And so that's how I ended up in publishing. And then I worked, so that was one of the trends journals at Elsevier, and I worked there for about 7 years in various different roles, launching journals and sort of developing new products. And then from there came this opportunity to work with VTech Traj, who is a serial entrepreneur, particularly in the scholarly communication space, but also actually in navigation. So he was one of the first people to put maps on mobile phones, as very few people know, but he's very, very interesting individual. And for about 30, 40 years has been developing new, innovative, very forward-thinking ways of taking scholarly communication forward, including the very first big community on the internet called BioMedNet, which at the time there's a million biologists as an online community. He then was really the father figure of open access. He launched the BioMed Central series. He founded the Current Opinion series, which again at the time were really very forward thinking in terms of how to do reviews. And he most recently had launched Faculty of 1000, which actually was launched to do something completely different, hence its name. So it was originally a virtual faculty of 1,000 biologists, and their task was, as they did their research, they would obviously read lots of papers, and they would identify papers that they thought were particularly interesting for one reason or another, and they'd write a short recommendation to say what was interesting about it and sort of points of note. And this created essentially a database of recommendations. As you might imagine, quite quickly realised he did more than 1,000 biologists, and indeed expanded into medicine as well. And so obviously couldn't change the name of the company, so it became from Faculty of 1,000 to F1000. So I joined him actually on another company that he had at the time, which is more for the pharmaceutical industry, but then moved over to working on F1000. And he was interested in really trying to rethink scholarly communication. So obviously he'd launched BioMed Central in terms of, trying to drive a movement towards open access, but was really keen to think about actually there's lots of other issues in a way research is communicated and published. And if you started again, and particularly the technology that we now all have, how would you do it? And so that was really where 1000 Research came in. So that's what we launched together 10 years ago, in fact, which was really trying to think, you know, how would you do scholarly publishing in a different way?
Okay, and then the different way was also like to first publish and then add peer review on top. That was quite a novel.
Yes, so at the time it was ahead of BioArchive, which is obviously Archive had been around in the physics community for a long time, but that was really the only community. There was a little bit of biology that sort of picked it up, but you know, really it was mostly the sort of physics and computer science, a bit of the maths community that were preprinting. And open peer review was not that common, and certainly not open peer review on everything. So again, some of the medical journals, particularly BMJ and BMC, were doing open peer review, but not more broadly than that. And open data was something that pretty much nobody was doing at that point. And so we really wanted to bring transparency into the whole process. So you could actually see what was going on. And through bringing transparency, you bring rigor, you try and minimize biases as much as you can. And so that's really where the model came about, which is essentially a combination of sort of the best parts of a preprint and the best parts of journal publishing and sort of bringing them together.
Mm-hmm.
So really enabling a researcher to communicate whatever they want when they're ready, which is, you know, very much one of the key benefits of a preprint, is there's nobody there to stop you as long as it's, you know, a research article. There's no ethical issues around what you're sharing. And that obviously helps address some of the publication biases that we often see and often talked about. And then the idea is that you can, that the data is there alongside it. So you have to be able to back up the research, because actually the data really is the core of the research rather than the narrative that goes around it. And equally the software code and you know, the methods and materials, you need all that information there. That actually is the core of the paper. And then the peer review process is transparent. So you can see who the reviewers are, what they say. And the other piece is that it's living, so that it's got proper versioning in the system, so that researchers can update it, it can evolve, they can address concerns as they come up. And so really moving away from this concept of having one version of record or an article.
And how, like, from my experience with Africa Archive, now 5 years in the running, at the time when we launched, like, to solve a particular issue, the various, like, removing the various bottlenecks and challenges that African researchers face when with publishing, with biases, language barriers, this and that, it's like we thought, like, a preprint repository would be a no-brainer to adopt, but then obviously it needs marketing, education, awareness raising, opportunity highlighting, whatnot. Which is the actual work that's and now for you, like, 5 years earlier before we launched, and we're still there, like, 5 years later, it's still a struggle. But when you launched Faculty 1000 or F1000 now, how was it with the adoption of the service, and by, like, what initiatives did you take and ways to market the new product to the community?
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. And this is where a lot of new models really do struggle. And I think people underestimate how hard actually it is to try and shift the system and do something in a different way, because the incentives in the system do not support that. And particularly given that we were very clear and very careful to not get an impact factor, because I think our sense was that sort of journal-based metrics in general, you know, one of the core problems of a lot of the you know, issues in the way that research is communicated. And of course, most researchers are, you know, measured based around journal publications based on the venue and the name of the venue or the impact factor of the venue or other journal based metrics. So that was always going to be an uphill struggle. On top of which, as I say, we were the first publisher to have a mandatory data policy, and researchers were simply not used to the idea of sharing the data and didn't understand why, and didn't understand
until
the benefits.
Today, sadly, right? Like
it's, still... it's still true today. Yes, exactly. It's better, but it's still an issue.
But I think it's also mostly because everyone's data is so messy and it takes so much effort to clean it up and make it presentable, not understanding that data is supposed to be messy to a certain degree and you can only clean it up so much. But
yeah, no, you're quite right. I think there's also a problem that if you try and sort your data out at the end when you're publishing, it's far harder because suddenly you're being asked all these questions and you probably can't quite remember exactly what you did and how you did it and you've moved on. And, you know, whereas if you realise as a researcher, I'm going to need to do this, then as you go along, the quickest and simplest way is to actually just keep it tidy as you go along, track all the details of your methods and all the rest of it. And so it's an education process, but it's a long education process to get around that whole loop. But to try and address some of these things, there were a couple of things we did. The first thing, I mean, obviously, because we'd come out of the faculty of 1,000, and we had a surprising amount, I think, of support across that virtual faculty of really top names, actually, across biology and medicine, who are very supportive of trying to of what we were trying to do. Including around a data policy, where actually we got a lot of pushback immediately, and we went to the advisory board and said, do you think we're doing the right thing here? And to our surprise, they said, stand your ground, this is really important, you need to, you know, maintain that mandatory policy. And just explain to people, it was interesting, you explain to the researchers why we're asking for it, why it's good for the community, but also why it's good for you as a researcher. And invariably, they would then share the data. But it's just a really time-consuming thing to do. So that was the first thing that sort of helped, I think, was having key leaders around the communities that we were working with, particularly bioinformatics, genomics. So those are areas where researchers are used to sharing, used to openness and transparency. And then the second thing we did, which I think has made the biggest difference, was really thinking about the fact that researchers are not incentivized, in fact, disincentivized, I would say, to publish in new entities like this. Who are the people that actually have the most influence over researchers? In my mind, that's the research funders. And so that's why we went out to look for partners as research funders, to really try and support a shift away from the traditional way of publishing. And we developed our partnership with Wellcome in 2016, Gates Foundation 2017, and indeed many other funders, the European Commission and others more recently, and indeed now societies and institutions and communities generally, where they would support, they would provide a venue, a publishing venue to their grantees, using this model of publication, and they would encourage their grantees to publish on there. And that, I think, has probably had the largest impact in terms of supporting researchers and making them feel like, you know, it's going to count if I publish on here, even though I don't get an impact factor publication at the end of it.
Oh, okay. So they made it semi-mandatory to publish in a short list of venues, basically.
Or not mandatory, not at all.
Recommended.
But encourage them, this is a good place, we think this is a good thing for you to do, that kind of thing. Of course, we don't get, you know, the big top papers, but that's fine. Actually, there's an awful lot of research that researchers do that is just never shared. There's a huge amount of research waste. I know Ian Chalmers always quotes 85% of research waste in medicine. People will argue whether that's the right percentage or not, but it's very high.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot of people do never get shared, and that's, I think, one of the great things about preprints, Africa Archive, and, you know, many other preprints, is that it enables researchers to be able to share anything and everything that they've discovered. And some things will be small and incremental, and that's fine. It will be important to one or two people, and if it's important to one or two people, it helps them move forward, and therefore it's important to share. And also rebalances, I think, the literature and our understanding, rather than we only see what deemed a sort of big impactful findings. Mm-hmm. We also see the things that didn't work, and get a greater understanding of more broadly of what's going on.
So you would say you get a higher proportion of something towards negative results, like descriptions where researchers are more open about, we tried this, didn't work, but still we got that result, which wouldn't be accepted so easily into other venues.
Yes, I mean, we've certainly encouraged it heavily, as I know many other publishers have done, you know, sort of Sam Science Publishers Plus as an example, and I know preprints encourage this a lot too, is to encourage people to share those. We actually ran quite early on a big campaign to try and encourage people to publish them. We got a reasonable number, but not the kind of volumes we were hoping for, and did a bit of research afterwards to sort of reach out to people and say, why didn't you? And I think the main reasons were either the time it takes to write it up, when yes, I get a publication, but it's, I don't get as much credit for that as my big impactful paper. And secondly, the challenge with negative results is often in the lab, you'll do something a couple of times, it doesn't work, you move on. And actually, if you're going to write it up, you have to do it many more times than that and really make sure it's a solid finding and you haven't done something wrong, and you know, your reagents aren't wrong, or whatever it is that you're using or doing, that there's not something wrong in that before you go and publish it. And often, actually, you just don't have the time. It doesn't work, you're going to move on to something else. And I think there's a bit of a problem with that as well.
Yeah.
It would take more effort and more research to prove it genuinely doesn't work.
Yeah. And then resources like time, money, all of that.
Exactly.
Human labor. The biggest backlash that preprints still receive is quality assurance. How to make sure. I'm sure that was also a topic for you guys to deal with. Yeah, without going into too much detail, because it's been discussed back and forth, but what's your policy around, like, when you discover, oh, this research, like, after it's been published and not yet peer reviewed, actually shouldn't have been published in the first place because it's just poor or whatever, like, or what's your policy around quality assurance, in other words?
Yeah, so if something's already been published and it's found to be problematic, we have the same policies and adhere to the same CAPE guidelines, so Committee of Publication Ethics, as any journal. So, you know, we have the same retraction policies and withdrawal policies and all the rest of it, and so we adhere to the same things. But there are a couple of things. I mean, that's for when things are really fundamentally problematic, right? I think there is a couple of things here, though. One is, although we are, the first step in our process is like a preprint. What I think is different there is the level of checks that we do. And they really are quite extensive. And in fact, we're doing some work at the moment to actually make it far more visible to the readers and the community more generally what things have been checked. So much more rigor around the integrity and information and the ethics and et cetera, but also particularly around more open research elements. So, you know, the rigor of the method section, does it adhere to standards, to reporting guidelines? Do we have detail of the materials that we used, ideally with unique identifiers? Do we have the data? Is it in the right format? Is it stored in the right place? Is it, you know, can people access it? You know, all of those things. So it's actually quite an extensive set of checks. And I think by asking for the research data helps to address some integrity aspects, because, you know, it's harder to fabricate data or, you know, edit data without it being more obvious. But then the flip side is, once you publish, I mean, so we reject about 50% of what's submitted before it's even published, just going through that process. And then once it's published, because the peer review process is open and because there's versioning, it allows, you know, if a reviewer says, hang on a minute, you haven't quite got that right, or that analysis isn't quite correct, or your conclusions are way out from what you've actually seen, or whatever, the authors can revise, they can address it. It's an evolving thing, right? And it changes, I think, the nature of the peer review to really make it almost a collaboration, as in the reviewers are there to help the authors improve the quality of what they found. So I think the transparency across the process helps with the integrity, but I do think we need probably more checks across the board. And I think, you know, as a community, you know, preprint servers, publishers, you know, and others indeed that are doing various types of validation on top of preprints, I think we need to come together and agree a set of sort of standards. And there are some of this is already happening. PLOS is already doing the open science indicators. We've already got a Centre of Open Science doing various types of badges and things. But I think it would be really helpful for the community for us to have consistency about how we talk about what checks have and haven't been done. And checks, I mean, ranging from basic checks through to peer review. They're all sort of different types of checks. I think we need to elevate non-peer review checks, because for small incremental studies, that may be all we need. We don't need full-blown peer review on every single thing, which is why I think we've got such a massive peer review burden issue. We need to recognise the value of some of these checks, but we need people to be able to, when they come across a finding on any of these kind of venues, to understand what has been checked, what hasn't been checked, what's it passed, what's it not passed. So I think there's a real task for us all together to do that.
Yeah, and also to acknowledge that not every reviewer can possibly know everything they're supposed to validate or counter-validate on a research paper. I like very much the fact when you said that the process is set up in such a way that it's actually supporting the researchers to present the results in the best possible way. And instead of how it often happens, sending them back to the lab to repeat their experiments or add other experiments, they don't even have the resources or time for anymore. This is, I think, one of the most discouraging reviews you can get, like of worrying in the second range of experiments, other projects, but not, and now a review from a paper that we actually planned to publish 2 years ago comes back like, what?
Exactly. I mean, it's, but I think, I mean, your point about reviewers, you know, and it only being a couple of years, I think is really important, because we as a community put this huge weight on the fact that a couple of people have looked at it, probably rushed in between a load of other things that they're trying to get done too. And we assume once they've looked at it, you know, if they've said it looks fine, it must be correct. And if they haven't looked at it, it must be wrong, or it's likely to be wrong. And it just doesn't make any sense. But the other thing is, I think we peer review everything in the same way. And so, as you say, you know, if it's a really big study with lots of different, you know, methods and really, you know, quite an important outcome, you need a really solid peer review. And it may be that it's valid to say, actually, you need an additional thing here to really make that a solid conclusion. If it's a small incremental finding, we don't need that kind of peer review, probably not from the same kind of people, not to the same extent. You know, we're wasting a lot of people's time on really small things that are only going to impact and benefit a couple of people anyway, potentially. And I think we need to be much more nuanced about how we peer review, who peer reviews. I think we can broaden the pool of peer reviewers much more for all sorts of different types of findings, rather than, you know, consistently have the same type of people being targeted again and again, everything. So I think there's a lot of work for us all to do there.
Yeah. Just like from the system, how it's set up, how much of a rebuttal is possible on the review level? I know that, like, I've also with a colleague published a paper in Faculty F1000. People still say Faculty 1000, because my supervisor at the PhD 10 years ago used to say, but it's known as
F1000. F1000, yes.
Okay. So it sounds very posh when you say Faculty 1000. So basically, so that you have the reviewer reports, which you can openly see on the right panel. And then there is a section for the authors. Well, authors can send their responses via email or through the system to the reviewers directly, and it doesn't necessarily have to show up in the system, I think, from what I remember. Oh, it will be displayed. But then can the reviewers respond to the response? Or does it
absolutely
end? Oh, okay.
No, absolutely. So we encourage authors to respond to the reviewers, and those will be obviously published alongside the peer review report. But equally, the reviewers can respond back. I mean, it gives an opportunity for authors to say, actually, reviewer, you misunderstood this, or I don't agree with you, or whatever. Or great point, I'll make the change. Whatever it is, right? And allows that discussion back and forth, including with readers. So readers can get involved in the conversation too.
Yeah, there's
As
a
we
comment.
know on all sites, it's actually often quite difficult to get people to publicly comment, which I think is unfortunate. I guess there aren't incentives in most cases to do that. But there are papers that are, whether they're more controversial or they're more impactful, where we have had a lot of good discussion between the authors, the reviewers, others getting stuck in. We've had people talk about the papers on Twitter, and we've encouraged them to pull that onto the paper as well, so that it's not lost, it's all kind of there together. And I think it's really valuable and important actually for a reader to be able to see that discussion and be able to understand the different perspectives and debates around it. Because a lot of areas, there is a lot of debate and different viewpoints, and who knows which one is the right viewpoint, but at least you can see that breadth and see where those discussion points are.
Yeah, exactly. Like we're researchers, or as researchers, we literally work at the edge of knowledge. So none of us can really know for sure what's being presented and how it's to be interpreted. And every researcher comes with their own package of experiences and assumptions of how data is supposed to be interpreted based on where they're coming from and what discipline or research area. So yeah, I very much appreciate the move towards, again, like to have it as a collegial exercise instead of a bottleneck and top down activity. So now there's some efforts in reusing peer reviews across different journal systems, which in your case, I think would make sense because it's already public. Or do you see a way to tie that in with other? No, whatever is being published in the F1000 stays there. I think we're talking more about closed peer review, and that then the review reports can be passed down to other editorial boards to consider, instead of
Yes,
one
I mean,
person to have such redundancy and extra work.
yeah, I think there are some great initiatives out there looking at how we can reuse those peer review reports, because as you say, it's often what happens is that it's if it's rejected from that journal, then you're starting again somewhere else. We're keen to engage with that. It's harder for us because we require the full transparency of the peer review, including the reviewer's name. And so if the review's been done elsewhere, we need to make sure that obviously the reviewer is happy for their name and review report to go up. But in principle, very, happy to share those. It's, I think one thing that will help is, as a community, is to have more standards around who, what, the type of things that we might ask in a peer review report, because this is often the challenge, isn't it? Is that I think, or go to another journal, unless you've got, say, review commons, where you've got a set of journals and a set of editors who have pre-agreed that whoever gets the peer review report, I will recognize it and count it. Then you do have the challenge that often editors will say, well, I want to invite my own people that I know, or it doesn't quite answer the questions that I want answering, or all of those kind of things. So I think having some elements of consistency around it, not they're all exactly the same, so they're not all going to be, but I think probably help there. But I think it's important for us to figure out how to do that. The challenge, I know this is a challenge with all the groups that are sort of been doing this at the moment, is how to make this work in a financially a sustainable way, because often the work will have been done somewhere else by a completely different entity, and the entity that then gets the publication might be, a different publisher or a different community or a different whatever it is. And so how do you make that system work? I mean, ideally, where and obviously this all connects into the whole APC system, which in itself is problematic. But certainly in an AP system, you have a problem where, you know, the APC is being paid at the venue that didn't really do the work for it. And then you need some kind of agreement as to how you cover the costs. And this is where it gets very messy. Now I know there's a lot of, you know, work going in, and we're equally keen to figure out how we move beyond APC. So I think we all recognize, you know, there's significant benefits in having shifted certainly to open access, but I think probably, you know, over to where we are at the moment, but we've got, you know, significantly further to go to really try and fully address it, because it has just opened up new challenges and new imbalances in the system. And the solution to that may help us address some of the solutions around the sustainability, around being able to move around peer review. I mean, the other comment though is that we're still working in a system where the version record is all that matters.
Yeah.
And actually, to some extent, you've got your peer review, you've got your preprint somewhere, you've got peer reviews coming in, could come in from a number of different places, could come from one provider getting the peer review, doesn't really matter. And once it's, well, there's a question of what does passing peer review mean? It's arbitrary. And everybody's got a different view as to what counts as passing peer review. But once you've got those peer review reports in, and if you've got some positive peer review on there, actually, it should be done, right? There's this extra step that we require at the moment. It has to go into a publication, back to the journal venue names and impact factors. That doesn't really make sense. So, I mean, I think one of the things that VTech and I always sort of envisioned is the idea that ideally you would be in a place where you'd put your research out, you would maybe contract a supplier of some description to run and manage the independent peer review, which I think is important that it's independent. You've got, you know, that validity of the assessment that's been done on it. And then beyond that, maybe journals actually move to being more curators and sort of badging things. And essentially content can rise, right? More and more badges in different places.
Like but that's a vision I also had, like eventually with all these preprint initiatives, also like Africa. and like the call for the research community needs to own their output. But yes, we need editorial services, and there's not necessarily a harm for corporate publishers as long as it's affordable and kind of serves the system. And so I think we can all agree to that. But then, I also feel what you just said, like, don't we need more curation instead of more and more journals So especially the usual suspects, the big five has ventured into like thousands, like literally thousands of different journals with overlapping scopes of research. And then like, where's the curation aspect? And isn't that what we need to make sense of the information again in the first place? Why do we do research? And it's become such a game where it's like the research gets stuck in the publishing pipeline and that's where it ends, instead of being curated in a way that's meaningful and yes, assigning tags for research disciplines, but it's not granular enough, I feel, for other societal stakeholders to then go in and find the actual research that's relevant for their implementation on societal and environmental levels or industry even. Like I had a Jeff Funk on the podcast a couple of months ago by now, who said like it's actually measurable and it's really sad and threatening that innovation in the industry space has declined dramatically. So we're not innovating anymore because there's too much knowledge and too much unsorted knowledge out there to make sense of. And that's an extra problem, especially looking at the threats and challenges we're facing. I agree with you, like journals and publishers should take the curation, the content curation aspects more seriously again. But now how can you do that with 51,000? that was an advocate question, because you're focused on life sciences primarily, but not exclusively, or is this basically also where you have more the majority? And what is your curational approach to make sure that the information is reusable, not only by researchers, but also others who might be interested, like journalists or other societal actors? Or where do you see the role where, what you just said, where also Faculty 1000 in particular could head towards the next 10 years?
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. And I don't think we have all the answers at this point, but I mean, it's an interesting cycle, right? Because actually going back to Faculty 1000 at the beginning, the idea was never mind where the content is published, just flag up things that are particularly interesting. Maybe interesting for that community. It might be I don't know, a cell biology paper, and somebody from plant biology comes in and says, actually, this is really useful for us over here. Or, you know, it can be from a different field, right? Neurosciences and plant biology, whatever. And what was really interesting is the majority of what they picked up were not in those big, you know, top impact factor journals, right? There's lots of great stuff published all over the place. And there's lots of stuff that maybe isn't so great, probably published in some of the bigger titles. So I think we're sort of coming around, right? The hard bit, and this is what we've found challenging. I think we're probably in a better place now that we're part of Taylor and Francis, which obviously has a big corpus of journals across disciplines. Actually does have quite a lot in the science of technology, but obviously it also has a real strength in HSS, which we are increasingly publishing in on F1000 as well. I think there's an opportunity to really try and tackle that curation piece that I think many of us in the industry are trying to figure out how to do and how to shift the role of journals or the role of, I mean, journals are really a community of, you know, the editors, the sort of top leaders in the field, and a community of people around it. So you already have within a journal a basis of that curation. And that's why I say I think we need to rethink what that group do. The challenge is we can't do this as publishers alone, or as a community of sort of involved in communication research alone. We have to do this together with the funders and the institutions particularly, because it involves them changing how they measure the quality of the research, how they measure researchers for funding, for careers, etc. These things have to go hand in hand. There are some, you know, some starts and movement toward that. Obviously, eLife, I know Plus have been looking at this, you know, many others are sort of starting to try and figure out how to really make this publish, review, curate approach work. But there's lots of challenges with it currently. And, you know, the biggest one, I think, is shifting the incentive system, which obviously we can't do. So I think what's really essential is that we work together as a group of stakeholders to figure out, maybe start small, because when you try and tackle the whole thing, it's so big that nobody can really quite figure out how to move. Maybe we just start small. One particular area and actually just try and rethink this place. But as we know, cultural change is something that takes a long time. But I think that, you know, over the last 10 years, we've actually, looking at it, moved quite a way in many regards. In some regards we haven't, and in some regards we really have. But we've still got a long way to go to really make the shifts that I think we all want and can all see the benefit of.
But talking about which, what's the biggest achievement you think you and the 1000 team altogether achieved over the past years? Also, could also have been along the way. Like, what was a major milestone that you kind of placed?
I think the point at which probably had the most impact going forward was that initial partnership with Wellcome. I think that was a real, you know, tipping point for us, to, if you want to describe it that way, in the sense that, you know, publishers traditionally don't really work very closely with funders. And indeed, I think at that point it was very much everybody was blaming each other the problems in the system. I weren't really talking collaboratively with each other at all. And so that was a big step forward, and I think has really brought, you know, certainly, you know, in our discussions much closer in terms of really working together with the different stakeholders, has enabled, you know, it's a big step for a funder to do that too, right? I mean, funders don't have get involved in publishing normally or have their own publishing platform. So that was a big step for them, but it enabled and encouraged other major players to do something similar and to, you know, really start to work together to think about how can we do this collectively. So I think that's probably the biggest point. And I think having stuck with the data policy despite many pushes and challenges and hard questioning of really is this the right thing to do, I think absolutely was the right thing to do.
What was that? Arguments against? I mean, just blunt.
The arguments. Yeah, the argument against is if you go so far out to the ideal, there are so few people that be willing to come there that you'll get those that come there, but the rest of the community just won't. It's too big a jump for the rest of the community, and you actually won't move the community.
Because it's so much work to clean the data, to present.
Because it's too much work. You know, people worried about being scooped, don't have the time and the funding to do it, doesn't get properly incentivized and recognized at the end. You know, those are sort of the main arguments. And it is always a question of do we go right out there and say this is the ideal in terms of the transparency and we're going to stick to it, or actually is it more effective to do it step by step and sort of try and bring the community with you? And you know, you can argue it both ways. We ended up falling down of that. Actually, let's go for where we think we ought to be, because you can really argue why you think that should be and why that's better for everybody, for the researcher as well as the community, and then try and encourage more down that road. And it's great. You know, PLOS obviously then went out with a data policy. Others are now increasingly going out with the, you know, requirement data policy, which is great. And then you've got obviously some of the big policy, you know, funder policies and national policies around that too, which is really, really excellent to see.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that the incentive system is changing too slowly or not really, despite all the discussions and guidelines and principles and initiatives happening. But isn't your approach that you outlined in the beginning of this conversation, that the way you check for rigor upon acceptance into F1000, like to get it published in the first place, wouldn't that be a checkpoint also for research assessment to make sure that the methodology is clearly described and all of that? Like what we've been unlearning as a scientific community as a whole, researchers and publishers alike, to, because of lack of space in the print version, which is not an argument anymore, but still a habit, to just reverse that and then use that as an assessment. Wouldn't that be like the easiest way forward? And then to measure, I'm just saying, am I missing something? Yeah. And then instead of, well, we need to get rid of the impact factor, that's clear.
Yes.
And that's probably...
I think you're right. There's definitely something in there. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I think it's really important that we get consistency across us all as providers of checks at different levels, as to not that we're all doing necessarily the same checks, but we've all got the same definitions as to what a certain check is, right? So that then, you know, a organization can say, I only want you to cite content that's passed these types of checks or got these types of badges on it or whatever it is, right? Which gives them the sort of sense, okay, this has gone through a rigorous set of checks and I trust that these checks have been done. It's all down to obviously the trust side of things. And equally rebalancing that against peer review and the validation that gives. So it'll probably be hard. I mean, just as I think an increasing number of indexes, bibliographic indexes, are keen to start to think about how to index preprints and how to then include in there what level of validation has gone on there. It's hard for all of these entities to do it if we're all doing it in different ways and we don't surface actually what we do and don't do. And, you know, So I think that's why it's so important that we come up with some consistent language as to what different checks are, what's involved in them. And then, yeah, I you know, again, start small, figure out a pilot. I mean, it at least I think the growing awareness and recognition, understanding across most organizations around the world now around the importance of changing the incentive system. It surprised me, I'm on the board of DORA, and surprised me still the number of places that don't quite understand why or that we need to.
Why but I think that is improving. Why is this working for us? Why should we change it?
Exactly. Not so perfect. I think those conversations are happening, and it, and people are recognizing. So that's the first step, recognize the problem. And there are some institutions doing some good work to really trying to change the way they assess. But it's not just the institution, of course. Fundamentally, the people doing the assessment are the research community. And that's where we've really got to, you know, change minds about how things are done at all levels. And not just the next generation, the early career researchers, but also the more senior researchers who are doing the assessment. And regardless of what their institutional funded policy is, will naturally do it a certain way unless we really address that and explain why it's so important to think differently about it.
I'd like to invite you to, I don't know, maybe it's a bit too much to ask, but okay, so lately in discussions, I've come up with a thought and also expressed it, like, do we still have the luxury to do research just because, for the sake of it, just to learn? Or don't we have enough challenges to actually solve the issues that we've put on this planet as humankind? So basically it goes down to the question of why are we doing research, and then what is the publisher's role? Do you sometimes ask yourself these questions, and is F1000 trying to find a way, or would that be even considerable, to find a way to shape or to incentivize researchers to be more solution-oriented in their research and publish that primarily or preferably?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question. I think there is a real role for basic research that isn't all, you know, tied to a specific goal. Because I think, you know, when we look back at major discoveries that fundamentally actually have had a significant benefit on society, they've often come from basic research that's just exploring and understanding. So if we stop doing that, I think we'd...
No, I'm not questioning basic research per se, because I've also been in that community of researchers. There's applied research, if you just differentiate the two, applied research and basic research. But my background is in evolutionary development biology, to basically prove the classic animal tree of life right or wrong on a molecular level. And then that has to do with biodiversity. And when you can ask, so there's no direct impact, but also what we understand and can, again, measure, but also see the correlations between how different species evolved from each other and where are they still alive today. Like, it helps environmental protection and animal species protection in that regard eventually. Well, I don't know, but you can always argue. But the question is, should researchers in their research proposals argue more towards, and can that be also something that publishers take on? So, like, what's the purpose of this research in the first place?
Yes, I still think, I mean, there is a lot more of that. We see a lot more of that in a lot of, criteria. We don't, but, you know, the broader community, in terms of the criteria as to how you get funding for things, is you often do need to sort of try and extend it. Now, often people write things that I would say far-fetched, but, you know, you if you want to get funding, right, you're going to write some kind of connection on there. And so does that actually help shift things? I don't know. And I still think there is a role for more blue sky research, because I think, you know, you often don't know what the potential impact of it is, but often it does lead to discoveries that do have a significant impact. So I'm not so sure about that. What I do think, though, is that we probably, you know, society fund a huge amount of research, and actually
There is evidence that isn't really taking us any further forward at a greater pace. And I do wonder whether we, you know, whether we should do almost less research, better and better quality. I mean, it goes back to the data point that, you know, researchers say, well, I don't have time because I need to get more papers and all the rest of it. I'd rather they did fewer papers and was less output, but it was better quality. They'd done replicated things enough times to really be able to stand behind it. They'd shared things properly with that you can actually really reuse and really test out.
Yeah.
And we can probably build on solid foundations, whereas at the moment, everything's, you know, not that strong. And we have this whole reproducibility issue, as we know, across many fields. And so I do think there is a need for that. I think as publishers, I think our role as a service provider, it is to enable researchers to share findings they've shared. And it's then to support researchers in getting those findings to the right people, you know, so plain language summaries and all of those kind of, you know, ways of trying to get outputs to the right people so they have the impact that they, you know, should have in the right places. And back to your point about curation, I think there's definitely a role for publishers in thinking better about, there's a huge corpus, growing corpus of content. How do you support the research community in actually trying to find, you know, the gems amongst all of that and piece together what all of this means?
From here, do you see preprint repositories as a competitive place or part of the ecosystem or something that you're already working with in some sort of workflows? Are you kind of partnering with BioArchive? Sorry if I could have done my research better.
No, we do partner. We're part of their B2J ecosystem. We're often discuss with, you know, colleagues on preprint servers. I mean, I see preprint servers as part of the ecosystem. I think, you know, we all have different benefits that we can provide into that system, and I think they're an important part of the evolution of where we're going. So
So is there something you can basically share from what's next for F1000 for the next decade or 5 years plan? Basically,
yeah, I mean, I think it's many of the things that we've talked about. I think it's, you know, it's looking at that whole curation aspect. That is something that I think is really important that isn't solved and anywhere really, but I think is critical. I think it's looking at peer review and what peer review means and different types of peer review, really rethinking that. I think it's looking at the checks and really rebalancing validation more broadly.
That you're planning to change also the system in F1000 and how the peer review is being displayed or coordinated? Or is it, because it looks pretty straightforward and like the way it was set up a decade ago, still working? Or
yes, we are though looking at, yeah, we've learned a lot over the last 10 years about how that system works. So we are in the process of making some tweaks and adjustments to it, and there'll be more coming out in the next few months about those, and just really streamlining the process and making it easier for authors, easier for viewers, easier for readers. But we are looking actively at the checks part of it because it's such a big part of what we do, and it's pretty much invisible, and most people don't realize the amount of effort we go in to do that. And so that we will be doing. As you know, starting by making that a lot more visible, and then, you know, we're already starting to work with parts of the community to really think about how do we do that in a consistent way across the industry. So I think, you know, thinking about that validation side of things and rethinking some parts of it, I think is going to be really important. Obviously thinking about how we move collectively beyond APCs, I think it's going to be a really important thing for us to do. And as I say, thinking about that curation piece. So there are some big meaty challenges still to work on that we're, you know, actively working on with, you know, our sort of colleagues across the industry broadly, but also with other stakeholders in the community, because as I say, I think the only way we're going to solve a lot of these challenges is by working closely and collegially together. And I think the current sort of tension between sort of commercial providers and the community is probably, well, I can sort of partly recognise where it's coming from. It's unhelpful, actually. I think we need to, we've all got a lot to contribute to this. And I think we need to work collectively together if we're genuinely going to solve sort of the big issues that we've got today.
Yeah, I think also, like you said, like to make the processes, like also describe the quality check processes. I think that's a big learning curve for everyone, and then can also encourage others to up their game or to share theirs and then learn from each other.
Exactly.
And that will also help researchers to do better in the way they present their research in the first place. What are the biggest cost items for you with Faculty 1000 with the APCs? What's the biggest cost that give rise to the APC model, or basically make the biggest part of it, of the APC in Faculty 1000? No, I got it right.
It's a mixture of some of those checks, particularly around the more open research elements. That really does require a lot of human time.
I forget that, like when you described that, and it was like, wow, that's a lot of expertise you're recruiting for every submission.
it is. I think it's really important to do, but it is. And then it's the peer review. I mean, the peer review, as with every provider, it's increasingly challenging. It's getting harder and harder to find reviewers, because we're all largely targeting the same group with a growing corpus of content. And they're also getting busier doing other things too. And so it's managing that peer review process is the other part that I would say is most significant cost. We do actually display on our platforms, we have a sort of cost transparency wheel. So we're very open and transparent about the percentage of work that goes into the different elements around the service. But I'd say those are the two biggest ones.
Yeah, we can link to that. Another example for homework. Sorry about that. Is there some... Okay, like your latest piece on the scholarly kitchen about open infrastructure and how different service providers can purposefully and friendly instead of competitively work together to orchestrate not only scholarly publishing but science communication at large. In a nutshell, would you, can you summarize what you wrote there, or what's basically a short verbal description of your points made there?
Yeah, I guess exactly. I think we need to. I mean. All stakeholders actually need to work at providing much more unique identifiers across the system and capturing better metadata, because we all do that. We will take a lot of burden off researchers particularly, and that's the most important thing for us all to do, so that they can focus on doing the research, right? Rather than endlessly having to re-enter information into all our different systems, which also provides loopholes, by the way, for to enable where there is problematic behavior, it enables some of that and makes it easier to do that. So we certainly have tried to capture as much metadata and as much unique identifiers across the piece as we can, whether it's ORCID IDs or funder IDs or IDs on different types of outputs as well. And I think the more that we all do that, the more that we can connect the systems up and the infrastructures that we each have, the more we can make it easier for researchers and easier for us, easier to track integrity, and validate integrity of outputs and individuals and all the rest of it. So my argument is really to encourage all parts of the system to capture much greater metadata and therefore to enable parts of the system to be much better interoperable, which is critical.
But basically adopting persistent identifiers and also standards, metadata standards, so which are often not only discipline specific but down to the project level. So some metadata is But there is always, you would think, a cross-cut of what's a must-have as a metadata, like description, title, keywords, obviously. But then, and what is nice to have and what is discipline-specific. And some disciplines have that clearly defined, but then it's not often known to everyone in that community. So, or the genres are not aware of existing community standards. So who is there, like a central database for such? Anyways. Open question.
Well, there is bio sharing, or fair sharing, I should say, it's now called, which I was part of working with Susanna Sansoni from the University of Oxford and others that put together this big database which captured it captured policies of publishers, policies of funders, but also then captured standards across communities and trying to capture how validated are they, because at what point does it actually become a standard as opposed to somebody's proposed it and a couple of people agree but not everybody, it's all of those things. It's not straightforward to do, and then of course you've got things like the Equator networks have an awful lot of standards in there, and so there are some core places to go for some of those. But yeah, you're right, but I mean the first part is capturing the basic metadata, I think, is where we're still at, unfortunately. There are bits here and pockets there, but actually most of the system are not capturing the basics. And that's the first place to start, I think.
And it's removing redundancies and
exactly
typos and stuff. Well, okay. Is there anything that comes to mind that would you like to get off your chest as a result of this conversation? Because I get a feeling we've covered quite a range.
I think we've covered a lot. Absolutely. I think we've talked about some of the key things that I think are really important and areas that I think we need to collaborate on. I mean, I think that's the biggest thing here in my mind, is that we all need to work together to address the changes that are needed. And it's not going to be easy. It's not easy. We're seeing that. But I would hope to see in the next 5 to 10 years the same kind of speed of progress that I think actually we have made if we look back over the last 5 to 10 years. We need to continue and maintain that. And maybe even increase it would be really good. And it feels like mostly there's a willingness there to do that and a recognition of this. And now we actually just have to do it.
Yeah, I think so too. Like, it looks like most, if not all, stakeholders are willing to some extent at least. I mean, everybody's also protecting their own hood, but there's a common understanding that collaboration and is necessary in order to achieve the bigger goal of making research output applicable to societal needs, but also more efficient, also better, more rigorous, more transparent. I think we're all on the same boat now. It's just a matter of who's rowing in what direction. I think we're rowing towards the sunset or sundown. Like sunrise, I'm trying to find a sunrise. Yeah. Trying to find a positive ending here. That's an option. Yes.
Yeah. I think we are. I think we're going in the right direction. We're all gradually aligning bit by bit, so we're all kind of broadly going the same direction, which is great.
Yeah.
And now we really need to starts going.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rebecca. It's been quite an enlightening and exciting conversation to have.
Yeah, thank you. I very much enjoyed it. Well, thank you for asking me.
And all the best for the next 10 years with Afro1000 and wherever life takes us.
Indeed, and all the best to Afro1000 too.
Thank you.